We continue to shiur in Gemara.
Gemara says, there were three kings
that actually ruled over the entire globe. Every single land of the world was underneath their domination. These three kings were Achav, the king of the 10 tribes of Israel. He lived in the town of Eliyahu Hanavi. He was the evil king. It was day Eliyahu Hanavi stopped the rains. Second king was Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babel, Babylonia, one that drove the Jews out into Galut and destroyed the first Beit HaMikdash. And the third was Ahasuerus, king of Persia. These three ruled over the entire world. Though the Gemara says, let's find proof. In case of Achav, let's find proof from Psukim in the Torah. In case of Achav, it says that when Eliyahu HaNavi had stopped the rains, Hashem gave Eliyahu HaNavi the key to reign. There are three keys that are in the hands of Hashem only. No angel has power over these three. One is the key to birth for the child. One is the key to Triat HaMetim, bringing a dead person back to life. The third is the key to reign. So in this case, Eliyahu HaNavi was angry at the fact that the Jews were worshipping idols. He requested of Hashem to give him the key to reign, and Hashem granted this request. Since he had the key, which means the power over it, he halted all rain from the land of Eretz Yisrael. At that time, got to a point of such a heavy famine, the Jews were suffering so from this famine, that Achab became desperate. People were actually eating their own children, Barminan. So he called upon Ovadia, prophet who was there, and he said to him, go search everywhere and find Eliyahu HaNavi and bring him to me, because it's his fault that there's no rain. Ovadia went in search of Eliyahu HaNavi, and he met Eliyahu HaNavi, and he said to him these words. The King Achab has sent a message to every single nation in which he ordered them, decreed, that if they know where Eliyahu HaNavi is, they should reveal his whereabouts immediately. Well, the Gemara says, unless Achab, king of the Jews, had full power over all nations, how could he issue an order to all nations? This order can be given by one who's a ruler, king over there. Therefore, this statement proves that Achav was king over the entire world. This is the first king who ruled over the world. Second king who dominated the globe was Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babel. Babylonian Empire covered the globe, because we find that the prophet Yirmiyahu says that every nation, every kingdom, will serve the Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babel. Here we have testimony by the prophet Yirmiyahu. Third case was Ahasuerus, where the first sentence of the Megillah says he ruled over 127 lands from Hodu till Kush, and this was the whole world, every land in the world. The Gemara asks, how come we do not list also Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon? He also ruled over the entire world. Why doesn't the Gemara say there were four kings who ruled over the world? The Gemara answers, the first place, King Solomon at one time got himself into trouble. He got into an argument with the king of the Shedim, and the king of the Shedim tricked him, took away his kingdom from him, and he was left without a kingdom. So, therefore, since the result was he was not a king anymore, we do not list him among those who ruled over the world. Now, even if we say that eventually King Solomon got his kingdom back, he was king at the end, Still, the Gemara does not want to list him among these kings because the Gemara lists only kings who ruled over the physical world. But Shlomo HaMelech is different. He ruled not only the physical, he ruled over the spiritual too. He ruled over what's known as the upper world, the world of the Shedim, the world of the spirits. Therefore, he is not classified together with the ordinary kings who ruled over the world. The Gemara asks, why don't we list Sancheiriv, king of Ashur? Since we are listing kings who are unusual in that they ruled over the world, the Torah tells us that Sancheiriv conquered the entire globe. Then he came to attack. He was the one who drove out the 10 tribes of Israel into Galut. Then he came to attack the 2 tribes of Israel. It was called Malchut Yehuda. Chizkiyahu, the king, great-grandson of King David, was king then. Chizkiyahu was a king, Tzaddik, who was so great at Tzaddik that in his time, every man, woman, and child knew the entire Gemara. And he was very poor as far as military strength. There was no chance whatsoever for Chizkiyahu's small kingdom to battle against this mighty, powerful emperor, Sancheiriv. So the Torah tells us that Sancheiriv came and besieged the city, ready to attack it. Which still we see, but he did rule over the world. Why don't we classify him among those special kings who ruled the world? The Gemara answers, let's see the end of the story. Sancheiriv never got to include Yerushalayim in his conquests. We list only those who ruled literally the entire world. If one thing is missing, we don't list them. Sancheiriv got to Yerushalayim, but never got into it, because his army came to Yerushalayim. Chizkiyahu, the king, prayed to Hashem, Chizkiyahu at Tzaddik, and then Hashem made a miracle where that night, over 180,000 of Sancheiriv's soldiers died in a plague. But he never got into Yerushalayim. Therefore, we cannot list him as one of these kings. Tosafot asks a simple question. The one that we know, most famous king, that ruled over the entire world, literally, conquered every inch of the world and even went beyond to the hidden parts of the world, was Alexander the Great. He went so far that he went to attack and conquer even the hidden kingdom in Africa, the kingdom of the 10 tribes of Israel, special hidden kingdoms of women, or a kingdom that came close to Gan Eden on earth. Why don't we list him as one of the kings who ruled the world? Tosafot answers, the Gemara lists only those that we know, not from history, but from actual Pesukim in the Torah. Alexander the Great lived during the second Beit HaMikdash, but we do not have the written Torah anymore. That's listed only in the oral Torah, the Gemara. That's why his name is not mentioned as one of them. And very fittingly, tomorrow night is Lag BaOmer, the Yudulah Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai Zal. The Gemara tells us now a discussion between Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai Zal and his students. Students asked Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai Zal a question. Why is it that the Jews had a decree of complete extermination against them in the time of Haman? Haman gave out a decree with the seal of Ahasuerus that every single Jew in the world, throughout all the lands of Ahasuerus, should be wiped out on this 13th day of Adar. Why did the Jews merit, why did they rate, deserve such a harsh decree? What did they do to deserve this? Rabbi Shmuel Chayezal is said to them, you ask the question, you tell me why. What reason do you give for it? They said, we believe it's because Ahasuerus made a party, a feast, for all his lands, and the Jews partook of this feast because they ate of the food of Ahasuerus, this Teref food, Teref wine, Therefore, the decree of death was given against them. Ishwili Haizal said, your answer is not sufficient, because if that's the case, only the Jews in Shushan, capital city of Persia, where the party took place, should have been killed. Why did the decree reach out for the Jews throughout the entire world? Why should they be included in such a decree? Therefore, so they said, all right, you tell us, Rabbi. They said the answer is, why the decree was issued is because they bowed to the idol. Which idol they bowed to? You recall, years before that, the time of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babel, the Torah, the book of Daniel, it says that the king Nebuchadnezzar built a tall idol, and his advisors told him, the advisors were jealous of Daniel and his three friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. They knew that they were favorites of the king, and they knew that these were Jews. They were very jealous of them, wanted to do away with them. They advised the king, build this idol and give out an order that every person in the kingdom must bow to this idol. Whoever does not bow to the idol receives a death penalty. This way they figured these servants of, these friends of Daniel would not bow to it. Daniel himself, of course, was exempt because he was so close to the king that he wasn't forced to do anything. But at least these three friends, these three prophets, the friends of Daniel, at least they would be trapped. The king gave out the order, and everyone bowed except these three, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. The Goyim figured now they had them. They'll get rid of them once and for all. The king summoned these three. They told them, you were ordered to bow before the idol. That's not the idea of the idol. If you are loyal to me, you must obey my order. And I cannot rescind an order. Once a king issues an order, it must be fulfilled. The three said to the Nebuchadnezzar, you are our king as far as our physical being is concerned. We can issue tax orders against us, labor, anything. But as far as our spirit is concerned, you and a dog are the same. King heard this, he said, you deserve death by fire. You'd be thrown into a pit of fire, and there be destroyed. Zohar Kadosh says, what prompted these three to accept this death so readily? Was they thought of the fact that the days of 10 plagues in Egypt, when Hashem sent frogs, second plague, the Torah tells us that the frogs, they were frogs, but they were also messengers of Hashem. These frogs were aware of the fact they were actually carrying out an order by Hashem. They went into the homes of the Egyptians, and they even went into the burning ovens because they had to cover every inch of ground in Egypt. So these frogs could go for the sake of Hashem's command. If they could go into burning ovens, we too could do it, should do it. Hashem's command is not to bow to idols. Therefore, we too will go into the pit of fire. And the Torah tells us, this is written in the book of prophets, the three of them were thrown into this pit of fire. Up in heaven, Hashem said to the angel Gavriel, he said, you go down and save them. Because before this, their forefather was thrown into the pit of fire too, Avraham Avinu. At that time, you volunteered to save him, and I didn't give you permission to do it. I said that he is one Jew in the world, and Hashem is one Hashem, it is fitting for one to save one. But because you volunteered then, I promised you I'd repay you for that good suggestion on your part. But now, this is your chance to receive your reward. Go down and save the three descendants of Avraham Avinu. Now, the Pasuk tells us that Nebuchadnezzar looked into the pit of fire, and he asked, how come I threw three in there and I see four now? And this fourth one looks very unusual, heavenly. His advisors told him this is a trick. That pit of fire is not hot. So he said, that's a good point you have there. We must prove it, and you will doubt the holiness of these three. You prove it. Go into that pit of fire. As they approached it, it was so hot, just when they approached it alone, they were consumed by this, for the heat of this fire, and they were killed. From that time on, Nebuchadnezzar never questioned the greatness of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, never dared to ask them to commit anything wrong against their religion. However, Yishmael Bar Yochai Hazal said, since these three were the only ones who were willing to sacrifice themselves, not to bow to the idol, that means that the rest of the Jews did. Therefore, because they bowed to the idol, that's why the decree was given out for all Jews to be wiped out. The Yemena asks, if that's the case, the students ask Rabbi Shmuel Yechayzel, if that was the case, how come they were saved? Why should there be a miracle in Purim saving them if they actually bowed to the idol? Shmuel Yechayzel answered, because they did not bow to the idol out of belief, faith. They bowed out of force, fear of death. Now, we have a law in the Torah which says that any time there's a question of life and death, any law in the Torah can be broken in order to save a person's life. For example, a person's life is at stake, you can break Shabbat. You can eat on Kippur. You can eat Tarif, so on. But if it's a question of idol worship, and a person is told, worship the idol or die, here his life is less valuable. He must sacrifice his life rather than to worship the idol. Now, what if a person didn't fulfill that order? He did worship the idol, did not sacrifice his life because he wasn't that brave. He didn't have the courage enough to give up his life. Bidi Evad, if he did it, there is no death penalty for it. Because we know that this person didn't commit the sin willingly, didn't do it out of faith in the idol. He was compelled against his will by force. So there's no death penalty. He deserves a much smaller penalty. That's what the Jews got. They got the scare, which was bad enough, the scare that they're going to be wiped out. This was their penalty, but they did not actually bow to the idol willingly, knowingly, or with belief in it. That's why the decree of death was not carried out against them. Now let's take the question once more. Let's analyze what... This was a deep discussion. They asked Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochayzal, why did the Jews receive this decree from heaven against them, a decree which said that every man, woman, and child shall die the time of Haman? Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochayzal answered, you tell me why. They said because they ate from the feast of Ahasuerus. Well, if they ask the question, that means they don't know the answer. A student asks a rabbi a question, he expects an answer. Why did Rabbi Shmuel Yechayzal tell them, you give me the answer? They're the ones that are asking. How does he come and say, you tell me the answer? Point is that, of course, these students who asked the question came with a claim that the way the question was put was obvious that they understood something, but not completely. They felt that the Jews did deserve a penalty. They asked only how come there was Kliya. Kliya means complete extermination of all Jews, men, women, and children. Why so much? In fact, to use that term, Kliya, complete extermination, this is what Yishmael Bar Yochayzal asked them, you tell me, why you believe that they deserve the partial penalty. What's your reasoning for partial penalty? In other words, not men, women, and children, at least all men deserved it. Well, they told Rabbi Shmuel Yechayzal the reason we believe they deserve a partial penalty, and it's for men alone because they ate from the feast of Ahasuerus. He told them you're wrong even there, because in that case, only the men in the capital Shushan would deserve it, not the ones in other lands. Therefore, I'll give you the answer why it's the people in other lands too, why all Jews. Because of the fact that they worship this idol, But they did not have this penalty carried out against them, since they did not actually worship it willfully. In the Megillah, we find the beginning of the story, where it says the king made a feast for 7 days. But it says on the seventh day, when the king had drunk his fill with wine, then they got into a discussion about beauty of women. So the Megillah says, why does it say the seventh day? Why does the Megillah stress on the word on the seventh day? The Megillah answers to show us, look at the difference between the elegance, refinement of the Jew as a people compared to Goyim. Here, the Goyim celebrate. When the seventh day comes around, they're completely drunk. Their minds are not clear anymore. They start committing sins and crimes that are completely immoral. The Jew goes through 6 days of work, eating, whatever he does. The seventh day comes, that's the holiest day possible. Shabbat comes, that's completely holy. Well, Shabbat, he goes to Knis, and there he says words of praise, songs to Hashem, sacred. What happened on the seventh day? The Chashverosh got into a discussion with the ministers, prime ministers of the other kingdoms, and they started to discuss the beauty of women. Each one claimed that each certain country is one that produces the greatest degree of beauty. The Chashverosh told them, no one compares to the beauty of Vashti, my queen. She is from the Castile, different land, certain section of Persia, and she has more beauty than any woman of any country on earth. So they said to him, fine, this drunken stage, they lost their respect for the king. They would never dare speak this way. But they said to him, we want proof. Show us. But we know that any woman dressed up in a bridal gown looks better than a woman who's not dressed up. And certainly a woman who's dressed up in royal clothes, royal garments, a queen's crown, naturally has beauty added to her. We want proof that she has natural beauty without these garments. Ahasuerus agreed to this immoral act to bring her unclothed on this seventh day. The Emet says, why did this work out so that Vashti should have to undergo such a shame and embarrassment? Because Vashti was so evil, so against Jews, that she had maids serving her every day of the week, maids of different lands, different countries, different beliefs. And she selected, especially on the seventh day on Shabbat, Jewish women to serve her. They'd be forced to break Shabbat. And these women should be forced to go without clothes, too, to hold them for embarrassment. The Emet says, Hashem repays a crime in the same measure. You thought you could make the Jews suffer on the seventh day, Jewish women, and embarrass them? You're going to have your downfall on this very same day. And that's why she was summoned to come before the king in this embarrassing position. The Gemara asks, what was so embarrassing for Vashti? After all, Vashti was completely immoral. Vashti had no sense of shame whatsoever. She was ready to parade openly in front of these ministers, pride herself, without any degree of shame or embarrassment. So how come that the Megillah tells us that she refused to come when the king summoned her? The Gemara answers, because two things happened to her. One, she suddenly developed a case of leprosy. And leprosy means a skin disease with such blemishes that hurt not just her looks but her pride. Secondly, to add to this shame, a malach came down from heaven and added a tail to her, a long tail. But this was so embarrassing, she could never face them. It was worth even dying rather than come out to be shown to be seen by all the king's ministers. When she refused, the Megillah says further that the king became infuriated. His anger burned within him. And the question is, why should he be so angry? Just because she doesn't come. Many men whose wives refused to obey an order, in fact, practically all of them. Aside from that, this wasn't such a strict order where it should bring such a degree of anger. Elena answers it wasn't just that she refused, it was that she sent a message to him, calling him a vile name in front of his ministers. You slave boy, you stable hand, because he was the stable hand of her father originally, and he killed her father, who was the king, and married her, because she embarrassed him with this message. You stable hand. Not only that, she sent him, my father was able to drink 1,000 cups of wine and not get drunk. You drink just a little more, and you're so drunk that you're making such demands. This caused him to become wild, insanely angry, and he issued the orders for her death. When he asked, Ahasuerus in general was a king who was not clever at all. He was called a tipesh, a fool, a dip. So he asked his advisors, he had his 7 advisors in front of him. He asked them, what should be done? The Megillah says that Nimuchan spoke up before the king's advisors and gave his advice to have Vashti killed and have an order given out that every man should rule in his home. No wife should be the ruler of his home, except all men should rule over their wives. Doesn't mean Haman was that good, but it was a beautiful advice. But the mothers prayed they had to die for that. The letter says now that why was Haman called Nimuchan? Nimuchan means prepared. Why didn't they just say Haman? The answer is that he was prepared. He was opening the way for his own suffering, because he, having destroyed Vashti, being the key, the cause to having Vashti destroyed, brought about the rule of Queen Esther, which eventually caused his downfall. But the letter says, well, here we see a very important lesson. Here we see that whenever you have a meeting, people gather to discuss a very important problem. Generally, they had yot. The dumbest one present jumps up first with a suggestion, with an idea. The Hedyot kofetz b'rosh, he jumps up first. Because here it says that Nimuchan spoke before the other ministers, and he was the lowest one. There's a sign that the thickest head is the one that shows himself first, instead of being discreet and reserved. Notice, watch always for the fool to jump out first. Of course, the Gemara says too that there's a debate. Was this really Haman? Two rabbis argue the point. The other one says this was not Haman, this was Lahabdil, the great Daniel himself. And even this says, why would Daniel come forth and say, Vashti should be killed, fine, but why give out an order to all the kingdoms from now on, every man should be the ruler of his home? Even this says that Daniel was so great, the greatest Jew alive, greatest prophet alive, the greatest tzaddik alive. He had rule over, influence over the king of the world, the Nebuchadnezzar. He had influence over the angels even. Angels feared him. He ruled over everyone. He dominated over everyone. He feared one person. One person only, and that was his wife. As great as he was, there's always that power behind, that the hidden strength of a female, a wife, a woman, that somehow rules over the biggest, greatest people, power behind the throne. For some reason, this so-called, this falsely termed weaker sex, weak, of course, is mentally, it might attribute it to them, but in general, their power is one. They wield a power over men. Even the biggest tzaddikim tremble before them. So Daniel, in his own personal desire, be able to rule over his mate, asked the king to issue this decree throughout all his kingdom. He'd finally get what he wanted, peace at home and complete domination. We need another Daniel today to save us. Now the Gemara says, very interesting point. The Sefer Devarei HaYamim is the last one of the 24 books of the written Torah. This Sefer we have generally list of names, names in history from creation through the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash. And there are so many names that are strange at times. Why all these names are listed? Names that we do not find in the Torah. The Gemara says that one rabbi said about this Sefer Devarei HaYamim, you have strange names. But we rabbis of the Gemara know how to decipher these names. For example, take one pasuk which is very difficult to understand. It says his wife, the Yehudia, the Jew, gave birth to Yered, Avi Gedor, El Chaver, Avi Socho, and Yekuti El, Avi Zenoach. These are the children of Batya, the daughter of Paro. Which, the one that Mered took for a wife. The Gemara says, now, let's analyze this pasuk carefully, and we'll see the message hidden in these words. Very deep message. First place, notice the pasuk began, and his wife, the Yehudia, and then it says later, and these are the children of Batya, the daughter of Paro. So if her name is Batya, why do we call her Yehudia? In the first place, the answer here is, but her name was Batya. Why was she called Yehudia, the Jew? And the word Yehudi, a Jew is called Yehudi because it has all the letters of Hashem's name. Yehuda, the words of Hashem, the Yehudia is Yud Kei Vav Kei in it, which means that a Jew is one who is completely holy. When is he called a Jew? For what? One who denies faith in Avodah Zarah. It means he believes implicitly in Hashem. That person is called with Hashem's name, Yehudia. Therefore, since Batya Bat Paro, at this moment, she came down to the Nile River, it says she came here to wash. What did she come to wash for? She came to put Tevilah, the mikveh there, to purify herself from Avodah Zarah and to adopt complete faith in Hashem as a giyurah, to convert. Therefore, once she came there to convert, I mean, she dropped all belief in Avodah Zarah. She was now called Yehudia. Batya, the daughter of Paro, but also Yehudia, a complete Jewess. Now, the next point is, it says that she gave birth. Is his wife? We didn't get to whose wife yet. His wife, Yehudia, we now know it's Batya, gave birth to Yered. You know, she didn't give birth. She saved Moshe Rabbeinu, and she raised him in her home, in the palace. Why does it say Yalda, she gave birth? The Gemara says this again teaches us that anybody who adopts an orphan and raises that orphan gets complete credit as though they actually gave birth to that child. The mitzvah of adopting an orphan is as great as adopting and raising, not just adopting, raising an orphan, boy or girl, yatom or yatoma, either one, raising him or her in his house, the Torah considers it as though this person gave birth to that orphan. Because here the Torah itself uses the word Yalda gave birth, which isn't true. The Torah would not say something which isn't true. The answer is that it is considered exactly as though this person gave birth to that orphan, and we could use the word gave birth to. Therefore, we know that Yedet is Moshe Rabbeinu. This Batya gave birth to Yedet. Why is Moshe Rabbeinu called Yedet? Yedad means to go down, to bring down. Because in the days of Moshe Rabbeinu, there came down from heaven the man for the Jews, therefore he is called Yedet. Now why is he called Avi Gedor, Avi Socho, and Avi Zenoach? Chaver, many more days. Even explains Gedor means, again, a fence. Because he built a fence around the Jews, not to allow them to be under-destroyed. Chaver, Chibur, means to attach, to tie, to bind. Because he bound the Jews to Hashem. Tied them, brought them close to Hashem. Sukho, or Sukho, because he was like a sukkah, covering a cloud of protection over the Jews. Yututi El, Tikvah means hope. Kael, hope to Hashem. Because in his days, the Jews continually hoped and prayed to Hashem. That the tefillot were constant under his leadership, that again brought them close to Hashem through their prayers. Zenoach means to remove. He removed the sins of the Jews. Through his prayers, he got their sins forgiven. Three times we find the word Avi. Avi means father of. Avi Gedor, Avi Sukko, Avi Zenoach. Because he was the father of Chochmah, the leader in Chochmah, the leader in Torah, and the leader in prophecy, Leviut. Then the end of the Pasuk says, and these are the children of Batya, the daughter of Paro, whom Mered took for a wife. Now, who's Mered? We know that Kalev is the one that married Batya, the daughter of Paro. Kalev was one of the two good spies that went to Israel. 12 spies went to Israel to spy out the land. And of them came back with evil reports. Two of them were good, Yehoshua, the student of Moshe Rabbeinu. Then Kalev ben Yefuneh, leader of the tribe of Yehuda. His name was Kalev. Why does the Torah call him here Mered? The answer, the Gemara says he's called Mered because Mered means to rebel. Just as he rebelled against the spies, therefore he's called Mered. So Hashem said, it is fitting that one who rebelled against evil should marry another one who rebelled against evil too. She rebelled against the idols of her father, house of Paro. This is a perfect match, a fitting match that let this one who rebelled Bikdusha and holiness against the spies or evil marry Batya, the daughter of Paro, who rebelled against her father's idols. These are the secret messages that are mentioned and are included in those coded words in Devarei Hayamim. Now we return again to the statements in the Megillah, where it says that Esther HaMalkah, speaking about her history of her life, says she had no father or mother. She was an orphan. Because when her mother became pregnant, her father died. He never saw her as a child. And then her mother never saw either because her mother died at childbirth. So she was an orphan from the moment she was born. Then it says that the Kacha Mordechai lo lebat. Mordechai took her for a daughter. The wording take the Kacha likuchin, the Gemara says, is a word that's used for kiddushin, for marriage. So we have to use the word not labat, but labayit. The Yereda says that the refined term for wife is not wife, but bayit. House. Housewife, housekeeper. The Yereda says that one of the rabbis, the Yereda says, I never call my wife my wife. I always call her my house because she's the akedata bayit. She's the pillar upon which the entire house rests. The entire household depends upon a wife and a mother. So the term used is bayit. So here, when it says Mordechai took her for a bat, it doesn't mean bat daughter. It's a short for the word bayit, or house, meaning wife. Question, why doesn't it say beferush? Why does the Megillah say he took her for a wife? The answer is that this Megillah had to be read partially even before the story of Purim happened, at least that part, so that there was no way for it was too risky for Mordechai to have to write down that she was his wife. If the king would know that she was the wife of Mordechai, she would automatically kill Mordechai first and then take Esther for herself. This was kept a secret from King Ahasuerus. Therefore, the secret is written in the form of code that Mordechai took her for a bayit, for a house, meaning for a wife. The word, of course, that gives it away is the word lekacha. Lekacha is lekuchin. Instead of saying that she was, haita, she was his daughter. She was his adopted daughter. It says lekacha, which means he married her. Married her means that she was his wife. Of course, we know naturally that she was the wife of Mordechai, but the Megillah had to be kept secretive. The Gemara says, where else do we find this fact that a wife is termed daughter? But we have to find it elsewhere too. We just can't say this is the origin. The Gemara says very simply, we find that when King David got into this problem with Bathsheba, he took Bathsheba, who allegedly was the wife of Uriah, and the prophet came to him and said, I have a problem for you. He came to charge him with this crime of taking somebody else's wife. He said, I have a problem for you. I want you to judge this problem. In the case of a very rich man in this town who has everything, and he has a neighbor who's very poor. He has nothing at all except one little lamb that he bought. And this lamb he raised with him. This lamb eats from his bread, drinks from his cup, sleeps in his bed, and she is like a daughter to him. Now, if she drinks from his cup of wine, what makes her a daughter? Why is that a daughter? The answer is, this does not mean daughter, this means bat, it means bayit, house. This refers to Uriah, who was poor, didn't have as much wealth as King David, and he calls Bathsheba his wife. Well, he uses the term daughter, so we see that the word bat, originally in the Torah itself, is used as wife, as bayit, and therefore this is proof that here too, very simply, the word bat, or Esther, means bayit, or wife. Now the Gemara says that while Esther HaMalkah was taken by the king's soldiers and kept in a special home, a place where all the women of beauty were gathered, they had to come and parade before the king to select the queen. While she was there, what did she eat? The Gemara says that she found favor in the eyes of the caretaker, and he fed her vegetables. One rabbi says that he fed her kidli dechazeri. He fed pig's meat. That's what he offered her to eat. Tosafot says that's what he offered her. Chas v'shalom, naturally, she did not eat it. And of course, according to the Zohar HaKadosh, the answer is very simple. The Zohar HaKadosh says, in general, how could she, as the wife of Mordechai, have lived with Ahasuerus? It's an impossibility. Though the Gemara says that legally it wasn't a crime, it was against her will, and so on, Zohar HaKadosh says that that's only theoretic questions, theoretic answers. In actuality, Chas v'shalom to say, by Lashon Hara against Esther HaMalkah, that Ahasuerus ever touched her with his smallest finger. What then? There was a Shedah, a female spirit in the form of the form of Esther, When it came to living with Achashverosh, this Sheidat took over the place of Esther, while Esther returned to Mordechai. Now, the Rizal says that we find in Tosafot a hint, a secret wording. Tosafot asks, again theoretically, if Esther HaMalkah did live with Achashverosh, how could the Pasuk say, at night she lived with Achashverosh, in the morning she returned to Mordechai, her husband? How could she ever live with Mordechai, her husband? She first must determine whether she's pregnant, whose child it is. But if she is pregnant, she's not allowed to go back to her husband until she finds out who the child belongs to. Tosafot answers that Haita mishamishet b'moch. Moch means she used a certain type of cloth, which would stop any chances of pregnancy. Now, Tosafot uses the word moch, and the Rizal says that word moch is the name of a female sheidah. She used moch, she used this female sheidah, therefore they know that she was not pregnant. And the same thing here, too, when it says he offered her these unkosher meats. Hey, it was the same.
Igula de Mishil Maye Chaizal Skurtoya Gerolel Vakoy Israel. The main highlight of the Igula is the Buddha Tanzel says to say, speak words about Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai Zal, and especially words that Shimon ben Yochai Zal himself said. We know that Rabbeinu Zal, or the Nechto ben Simcha Zal, is the Yimetria Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai Zal. That means that there is a not just direct connection, but an actual oneness between both. And in these words, the Hekdamah, the preface to the Rabbeinu Zal's Sekhar B'Kud De Maran, we see this brought out very clearly. Kenita Lee, Rabbeinu Zal says that any person, no matter how simple and ordinary, who studies a Sefer Kadosh, carefully delves into it, can find extraordinary Kiddushin. And so tonight, in these words, I believe we have found new lights. The words of the Rabbeinu Zal. Rabbeinu Zal begins, "Rechu chazu b'pamot Hashem." Come and see the deeds of Hashem, the actions of Hashem. Itkalut nifla, a marvelous revelation. We saw gedulat ha'taner al-kayin b'shim ben Yochai Zal, the secret of the greatness of a heavenly Tana, the heavenly Rabbi Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai Zal. This is the way Rabbeinu Zal begins. Rabbeinu Zal is about to reveal the secret of Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai Zal's race. First question is, why does Rabbeinu Zal begin with these words, "Lechu chazu b'falot Hashem"? Come and see the actions of Hashem. What has this got to do with the actions of Hashem? This is a pasuk in Tehillim. Bechu kazu b'falot Hashem asher sam shamot ta'aris. Come and see the actions of Hashem who has created, made destruction in the land.
When you're ready.
Wolim Avadishim asks, how can we say the actions of Hashem who made destruction? The word Hashem, this name of Hashem, is Hashem of Chesed, of kindness. Not the word that's used for vengeance or din. Therefore, the Gemara says, we must change the word Shamot. Who chazu b'falod Hashem, come and see the deeds of Hashem, asher san shemot baretz. Hashem who made names in this world. Every item that exists has a name. Every person that has a name. Hashem placed these names upon these people. Out. Before a person is born, The parents discuss what to call that child. And the Yemenis says, now Hashem some Shemot. Hashem places a name in the minds of these parents to call that child this name. Why? Because the name of that person is going to characterize the nature, the characteristics of that person. And this we know as a culture kid. Abinadal says that one who knows, one who understands Kabbalah, can see in the one word Adam, person, every single person in the entire world, if he understands that one word Adam. So Kol Shekein, surely, that in a person's name there can surely be found the truth about the nature and character of that person. But therefore, the Beinazal brings this pasuk to tell us that come and see the marvels of Hashem, that here we have a name, Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, and how in this name we will find the marvel, the unusual characteristics of the Kedusha and Hashem Yechayizel. That Mechu Chazu, come and see. No. That you can ask this name is very common. Kama Shimon Ika Bashuka. There were thousands of people of Jews with the name Shimon also. The answer that Benazal says is that a person is given a name and Hashem knows the future, but a person is not guided or impelled by his mazal. The smallest person with the worst mazal, through his own bechira, his own free choice, can become the biggest tzaddik. And this is the case of Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, who rose to such a great stature. Now Rabbi Nezal explains, he continues, Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, the tiach. Shimon ben Yochai promised, assured, and guaranteed, that the Torah will never be forgotten from the Jews. How? Through him. Through his guarantee, through his assistance. The Gemara brings the Shabbat. There's a machlok and a debate between the Chamim, the rabbis, and the Shimon ben Yochai. The rabbis say there will come a time when Chas V'Shalom, the Torah will be forgotten. It will come that kind of a very dark moment. There will be no more Torah. That moment will be a moment of darkness. Shimon ben Yochai says that darkness will never come. Chas v'shalom, Torah will never be forgotten. Why? Because there's a pasuk, Ki lo tishachach mipi zar'o. The Torah will never be forgotten from the children of Israel. But that pasuk will never be forgotten from his children. The last letters of those words are Yochai, which means because of his child, who's Rabbi Yochai's child, Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, therefore the Torah will not be forgotten. Why? Because the Zohar HaKadosh says, "Bezor Harda, Yekun Negeluta." Who the Zohar HaKadosh, which the Rishon Yechai Zal wrote, this will bring the Geula for the Jews. The word Zohar is light. The Zohar HaKadosh says, "As Kori Di Gemara, Imlo Berikshi, if not for the Torah, this entire world, the entire universe, the heaven and earth will become destroyed." There must be a Torah, otherwise there is no creation. The moment the Torah stops, Chas V'Shalom, everything disappears. So if there come a time when there be no Torah, it will be forgotten, that means this is the end of all creation. Bereishit bara Elokim. Bereishit is the letters Aleph Tav Reishim Bet Yud. That means Or Torah. The Torah like of Rabbi Yeshua ben Yochai Zal is what Bara continually creates now, keeps this creation in being of the heavens and the earth. Through the light of Rabbi Yeshua ben Yochai Zal's Torah. Which light is that? That's the light of the Zohar. Well, Rabbi Nezal says that the word Shikha, Shikha means to forget. Shikha is synonymous, that means the same as death, the same as darkness, and the same as Galut. On the contrary, the word zikarot, memory, to remember, is the same as life, the same as light, and the same as geula. Therefore, Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai Zal said, this will be, never be Torah forgot, because there will be, it will be remembered. Why? Since the Zohar HaKadosh, HaZohar, is the opposite of Shikha. Shikha is the letters HaChoshech, the darkness. That's forgetfulness. HaZohar is the light, the opposite, which means remembrance. And just as darkness means Gamut, so does HaZohar, the light, mean Geula. So through this light, Avraham Shimon Yochai Zal's Torah, the Jews will come out of Galut and be zofet to the Gula. Bezalf adds, though, the Da should know that what we said until now was a remez, a hint of a son of Rabbi Yochai Zal, Rabbi Shimon Yochai. There is also a pasuk in which there is hinted the name of Rabbi Shimon himself. Da ki atana kadosh Rabbi Shimon hu befinat ir v'kadish min Shemaya nachit. There's a pasuk in Bnei which says malach ir. Ir means a malach or one who is constantly awake. Kaddish and holy Mishmaya Nakit descended from heaven. The first letters of these words are the Mishimur. So in this sentence, the Ben Adal says, we find the Rashi Tevot, the first letters, symbolizing the name of Rabbi Shimon Yefayazi. What is the connection, this statement, with what we said before? Why does the Ben Adal bring, seemingly out of the clear blue, a Fasuk? True, the name of Rabbi Shimon Yefayazi is the first letters of Rashi Tevot. But what is the connection here? If we study that carefully, we find something extremely amazing. The word here, awake, means alive, constantly alive. A tzaddik emet never dies. He's always alive. Even when he passes away, he continues to live. Tzaddik after his death is called chai, alive. Kaddish and holy, that's the Tana Lekaita B'Shemei Yechayezel, min Shemaya Nachim, came down from heaven. To come down from heaven, you must first go up to heaven. We find that there is a pasuk similar to this. These words, "Be alai shamayin vayeda," who went up to heaven and came down? This was Moshe Rabbeinu, but he came down with the luchot, the two tablets. He brought the Torah to the Jews. Now we find that Rabbi Shimon Yechayezel is mentioned in the Zohar Kadosh as having reached the madrega, the level of Moshe Rabbeinu. Which level? A level of Moshe Rabbeinu coming down the second time with the second tablets. The first tablets were broken. They did not remain for the Jews. That's like Shikhah. The second tablets which remain, which the Jews have and will continue to have, that Madrega Rabbi Shimon Yechayezel reached. Rabbeinu says, Rabbi Shimon Yechayezel Idri Kaddish bin Shemaya Nachir. He descended from heaven, the same as Moshe Rabbeinu. He brought with him this is Matan Torah. His giving us the Torah, the Zohar Kadosh, is one that shall always remain. The same Madrega as Moshe Rabbeinu. Now we understand too. Rabbeinu Zohar finishes with these words, V'achshaz, and now. And now, Dachal Noveh Mitpor Pachlar. Now Rabbeinu Zohar, this is added to Rabbi Shimon Ben Yefayezel, V'achshav, now when the time, the moment of Geula is here. What is this addition? This is the vital combination of Torah and Tefillah. The Shulchan Aruch, as always said, is the symbol of Torah. Through him, we still have the Torah, and we will always have it. Rabbeinu Zohar adds to this, that with Torah alone, today we cannot get to the Gula, because a person can study Torah and learn Torah and find too many barriers and too many objections, too many difficulties in trying to fulfill the mitzvot of Yipurah. There is so much opposition now, so much hatred against religion, against ones that want to be religious, against ones that want to fulfill the Torah, that a person today with the knowledge of Torah alone can be so oppressed, actually crushed, Chas v'Shalom. Benedel says there's one thing he must do. He himself is incapable of carrying out these mitzvot. He must resort to the key, which is tefillah. The Tefillah prayer and it Bodedut. Through this, a person can then bring on the help, the assistance from heaven. Benazal's key was the Tefillah. That we see now these words, this it come with this revelation. Thus, Benazal said that the Mishim Yechayezal was Mishmaya Nachit, the same as Moshe Rabbeinu. Benazal too is Begimatri and Mishim Yechayezal, and therefore also in the category of Moshe Rabbeinu. We need this combination of both, Torah and Tefillah, the Mishum Yechayezal and Rabbeinu Zal, because the Zohar Kadosh says that Moshe Rabbeinu and Yosef HaTzadik and David HaMelech were nistalek, passed away on Shabbat. That means they rose up to heaven on Shabbat. This elevation, Shabbat, is the symbol of Yom Shekulo Shabbat, the Geula. Biat HaMashiach, the new world where Mashiach comes. When can we have Mashiach? We have the combination of these three. The Zohar Kadosh says, why these three? This is all hidden in the letter Aleph. The letter Aleph is a Vav, and two Yuds, one on each side. This comprises a letter Aleph. The Vav stands for the third letter of Hashem's name, which is Zayin Hapin, which is Moshe Rabbeinu. The Vav is 6, the two Yuds are 20. Together it's Hashem's name, this Aleph, 26. But this stands for the future, the Gula. The Vav is Moshe Rabbeinu, and the two Yuds are the two Mashiachs who will come with Moshe Rabbeinu. Mashiach ben David and Mashiach ben Yosef. So we have this combination of Moshe Rabbeinu and David and Yosef. These three combined, Zohar Kadosh says, Begimetria Tefillah, prayer. When you have these three, then you have Tefillah. And therefore, Rabbeinu Zal too. This will bring about the Gula. Rabbeinu Zal's name is Koleo. Begimetria, these three. Moshe Rabbeinu, Yosef HaTzadik, and David HaMelech. Rabbeinu Zal Begimetria Tefillah with the Koleo. And therefore, Rabbeinu Zal said, now, Nachal Levei Kol Pachmet. This is the Bechina of Moshe Rabbeinu, together with the two Mashiachs, with this, with Rabbi Shimon Yechai Zal's Zohar HaKadosh, and Rabbeinu Zal stressing of his Vav Tefillah. Combining these two, we are certain that there's a chut. But right now, night of Lag Ba'Omer, Shimon Yechai Zal's Hilula, well, this means the Hilula of Rabbeinu Zal too is combination, because both are Chai. Both were installed in the 18th day of the month, and Chai, both are alive. Combination of both Tzichuyot, we are certain it will be Zevchet now to see the Geula Shleima Be'emet, and yet Mashiach Tekenu Amin.